Myth of the self. Years ago, yes, it is certain I existed. I was there and nobody could have convinced me otherwise. I lived, I breathed, I loved, I listened, and I was. Then somehow, one day, this ceased to be the case. I became simply a word in a sentence, a meme in an escalatory narrative, a vagrant in semiotic hell. As a result, the world converted wholesale into a series of differential impressions, refracted through the distorting lens of a mythical self in which I was compelled to believe or lose everything. Henceforth, I was to be a storyteller, a spinner of webs, a weaver of fictions, not just when I chose to be, but all of the time, every day, world without end, amen. And the self in whom I was forced to place my faith, and in whose ghostly wake I now struggle to read my imminence, went from that moment onto a kind of life support that, although negligible at first, gradually took over, overwhelming its host and reducing him by stages to the inscrutable status of a cipher, a punctuation mark, and finally, the white space of the page itself. Maiden looked sidelong at the steam rising spasmodically from the mug of chicken soup on the table's edge and sighed. It was not going well. There was to be no salvation in fiction, at least not today. The sixth and last story, the one that was supposed to pull all of the others together, and it read more like a philosophical treatise than a compulsive narrative, more like a granite wall than a gently curving forest path. He stood up and stretched his arms, ran a hand through his tangled mess of hair, and looked around the strangely comforting horror that was his flat. All of the furniture was fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh hand, frayed, ragged, and covered like the tattered carpet with cigarette burns and stains, whose history Maiden could have recollected had anyone been available to ask him. The walls were spattered with what looked like blood, but what was actually a painterly mixture of cayenne pepper and tomato juice, the final exposition of an evening of particular self-loathing that had taken place some months ago. Jars, plates, crushed cider cans, and empty food packaging littered the floor, each receptacle filled with its own unique cache of cigarette butts and the paraphernalia of joint production. Pinned to the walls and even to some of the furniture were photographs, torn newspaper articles and club flyers, shards left over from a period when his life had had a more external dimension to it. And behind the sofa were stuffed thousands of pages of late-night musings, endless moments of clarity which he'd been forced to write down or lose, hoping one day to turn them into something coherent. Picking its way gingerly through the rubble, seemingly oblivious to the arcane significance of all of the objects, Maiden's cat Deus stopped and looked up at him, momentarily awed perhaps that something in the flat other than itself seemed to contain life. It meowed briefly and then returned to its daily task of patrolling what remained of the floor space and looking for stray threads dangling from the furniture or rolled up balls of paper to alleviate the monotony. The cat that I see and the cat that is seen are not the same, thought Maiden. One is the myth of the other, and the other, neither is real. The thought provided him with little comfort, seemed in fact to crystallize his current difficulties with the story. He realized he was losing contact with everyday common sense reality, largely as a consequence of having withdrawn or having been allowed to withdraw so totally from it. He hadn't left the flat for 3 weeks, having decided to seal himself off for the writing of the six stories, and for that whole time he had been living off packet soup, pasta, and tins of one sort and another. His telephone was cut off, the television showed only the number 3 superimposed upon fuzz on all channels, and there had not been a single visitor. But far from feeling down about it, he felt almost proud of his achievement, as if he had refined isolation to a high art, and, in celebration, he had a few days earlier pulled the thick curtains shut in every room and closed out the sunlight for good until it was over. The last human sound he'd heard had been a voice on the phone before it was disconnected, and even that was a wrong number, a Tim somebody or other, trying to get hold of a long-lost friend. Maiden had read about people dying in their homes and not being found for months, even years in some cases, and whilst the world had expressed its outrage at the fact that such a thing could happen in a civilized society, he had been almost impressed. How to disappear completely, he had thought, and had even planned at one point to write a handbook on the subject, on how you could gradually become so transparent, so diaphanous, that people literally looked right through you, ignored your presence, forgot that you existed. Because, of course, the self is, and is only ever a myth of self, a fiction which we sell to both ourselves and others, and it is sustained only on the condition that we sustain it in others, socially collaborate in the essential fakery of it all. Or so Maiden thought. Remembering the moment at his father's funeral when, standing by the graveside and not feeling as much as he knew he should, he realized that if you stripped away all the flesh, all a person comprised was a word, a name, a semantic entity that figured heavily in a number of intersecting narratives, the hero, perhaps, of its own and maybe even of others, but still, in the end, only a word, and thus subject to the same laws of vacancy as any other. He kicked out at a pizza box on the floor and sent it skittering across the room, frightening the cat, which ran for cover in the sepulchral darkness of the kitchen. If he'd been able to write just this one last story, then everything perhaps would have been all right. He could have re-emerged into the light like a creature from subaquatic hibernation, feeling that he had plumbed the inky depths and returned with something gleaming in his hand. But in truth, he felt as if the muse had deserted him, run off with another, and left him only with dry, wrinkled prose, arid and sterile, word upon word, to show for his journey. Throwing himself onto the sofa, and in doing so generating a mini explosion of polystyrene and paper, he rattled the bus queue of cider cans at its side one by one, checking for uncontaminated contents, and, finding one that felt relatively safe, took a long swig. His eyes settled on the mound of objects in the centre of the room. Books without covers, ripped up magazines, the sleeves of albums, a telephone directory open at the pizza page. As he stared at them, he felt something bother him, something like a small child pulling at his sleeve, outside his peripheral vision. He refocused his eyes to try and see what it was. There it was again. Something about their configuration, order in the chaos. A phrase, five words, each coming from a different source, but overlaid from the angle where he was sitting, in such a way that they made a sentence. The real is the impossible. There was even a phrase underneath, an album title that contained his name. He laughed, smirked at the ridiculousness of it, his clutter speaking to him, somehow ingeniously finding a voice. But what to make of the axiom? Had he heard it somewhere before? He took another pull on the cider, only to realize from the splattering of the contents around his lips that his hand was shaking badly. As abruptly as it had come, the laughter of the previous moment died back, transmogrifying into something colder and more desiccated. Yes, it was an intriguing coincidence, a random conjugation that by rights should not have been there. But at the same time, as he'd read it, he'd heard a voice, the first in over 3 weeks, and it had not been his own. It was uncanny, unheimlich, in the language of psychoanalysis, like some nameless oceanic horror erupting from the deep and breaking through the surface close by. At the thought, he found himself suddenly panicking, swallowing repeatedly, gulping on air, as if the cider had formed into a bolus in his throat and was unwilling to move in either direction. He sat up abruptly, acutely aware that if he didn't breathe properly soon, he would move into oxygen debt, and from there to unconsciousness, feeling for the first time in years the intense pang of total isolation, almost hermetic insulation from the society of others, of being face to face with an issue which is of consuming interest only to oneself. He stood up and staggered through the debris to the kitchen, knowing somehow instinctively that he had to get some clean, pure liquid, lots of it, down his throat, however hypothetical the obstruction. And, as he took mouthfuls of the stuff and compressed it with his tongue into his esophagus, he gradually felt the passageway clear and the crisis avert. By the end of it, he was left shaking, weakened, arms outstretched, resting on the sink, eyes trying to make sense of the darkness. And that was when he saw it, resolving slowly like an internet image, a chain of words reading vertically, almost hieroglyphically down the objects in the sink, another apparent message. Why is original best? He scrabbled at the items with his right hand, wanting to deny them their distributive logic, finding himself holding one by one a packet of coffee, a can of bitter, a bottle of whiskey, and a Listerine jar whose label had worn away in the water, leaving just two letters behind. Once again, he had heard the peculiar leaden voice in his head, slow and measured, even as it framed the slightly ungrammatical interrogative. And what was worse, he even felt as if he was under some sort of compulsion to answer it. For what was so special about the original? Why did it have such a high value across, as far as he knew, all cultures, all societies? He stared glumly down at the plug hole, hoping somehow to find enlightenment there in the tangled mess of spaghetti and coffee grains. There was little to go on, so he returned to the question, letting his eyes drift slowly upwards until they rested on the floral chasework of the blind. What was it that a copy or an imitation lacked that an original possessed? Presence of some sort, an investment, an energy? Something that added a unique ingredient to the mix of what was previously available and thereby moved things on? Whatever it was a quantity that he felt he particularly lacked at the moment. Being original was something he'd always found relatively easy until these last few years, and the loss of the facility seemed to be linked to his increasing transparency, his lack of solidity, his inability to be genuinely anything at all. And what of the origin itself from which the original proceeded? The phrase implied a singular source, but if so, was it internal or external to the being through which the truly innovative flowed? He suspected the latter. But then this implied some sort of God, a condition beyond the conditioned, an idea with which these days he had very little truck. That said, he had fallen out with the concept little by little over the years, and it was quite possible to track his diminishing faith together with the gradual fading of his gift, such that they mapped over each other like the trading figures of two departments in a failing company. Maiden groped his way back into the heavy silence of the living room, sensitized now to the language of litter, and looked around him for any more felicitous combinations. He didn't have far to look. On the coffee table by the sofa, three splayed books and a leaflet intoned across their covers, "There is no other of the other." How ludicrous, he thought. What an absurd proposition. Perhaps because the last term was a partially obscured version of the word, he couldn't help thinking about his mother, whom he used to visit every fortnight in the hope of tempering her alcoholism with his own more controlled version. That had stopped when, one drunken night, she had draped her arms around him and suggested that they go to bed together. He knew it was just the drink and the loneliness, and that she would undoubtedly have forgotten all about it in the morning. But all the same, he hadn't known what to say and had chosen to ignore the whole thing, shutting it away in the junk room with all the other strange events that had marked his passage through life. Such as his father, always wrapping his arm around his girlfriend's shoulders whenever they visited, and steering them off without even greeting him at the door. Such as the late-night phone calls from his mother after his death, threatening to commit suicide in an already lifeless voice, telling him she had razors in the bathroom. Such as the night he had spent in the matron's flat of an otherwise derelict mental hospital, frightened because there were people outside the door who that day had shaved off all of his hair, people who were unprepared to show themselves, but quite happy to creep menacingly around the outlying parts of the building. Yes, it had been original, and original is undoubtedly best. Now, when he looked around the room, he saw there were outlandish slogans everywhere. "Reality is thought in the refuse spilling from the fallen bin. Give peas a chance," pinned chaotically around the pinboard. "K is for catacalism," built haphazardly out of words and letters ripped from the metro. "Barcode the sky," emblazoned almost hieratically across the steps of a pile of books in the mire by his feet. The floors, walls, and surfaces virtually shouted them out one after another, whilst the peculiar voice in his head continued only to murmur insistently, like a bored teacher addressing a recalcitrant pupil. Were they all really there, or was he actually seeing patterns that his own mind was forming in advance and projecting onto the detritus? There were so many words present in the room, such a seething swamp of verbiage to choose from, that it was surely inevitable that there would be sensible-seeming sentences here and there. In addition, the room was by now, and the silence in it so all-engulfing that it was not surprising that he was hearing voices, that words were having to be spoken by any means necessary. He wondered if he had somehow just reached the point at which isolation becomes insupportable and the demand for society so overwhelming that it must be obeyed at all costs. Perhaps this is what schizophrenia is like, he thought stutteringly, the inevitable effect of becoming so cut off from others that objects become animated, words live and breathe, and something like sense seems to breathe through everywhere you turn. If so, then perhaps he was actually going mad. It was a proposition that, despite everything, he had never before seriously considered, and it made him long, more than anything, for a serious drink. But there was nothing but leftovers remaining in the flat. He would have to go out. For the first time in 3 weeks, he would have to open the front door and make the long, treacherous journey to the local off-license. Maiden sat down by the computer and buried his head in his hands, pushing the palms hard into his eyes. In the ebb and flow of the blackness, he half imagined he saw the room as if from hundreds of feet above, and it looked like a half-empty packing crate in a cellar or some madman's idea of a doll's house. Worse than that, it looked like a prison, a cell, something stifling, something that was about to seal over and incarcerate its puny occupant for all time. Certainly, he had to admit now that his time was up, his seclusion over, and the sixth and final story was still far from being completed. But perhaps that was the point. It could not be finished until he had broken the seal, the covenant that he had made with solitude, and opened the cell door, hand in hand with no one, aware for the first time of the true fragility of his being. He looked up at the computer screen and reached for the mouse, intending to shut down his abortive story for the evening, only to be stopped mid-action by the juddering realization that the last four words were not his own, had not been there before, and had thus appeared on the page entirely of their own accord. He was not even sure they made sense. Could they be the truncated version of something he had written earlier, a paragraph from which most of the words had become somehow deleted? Or had the machine itself, the software, glitched and thrown them up, vomited them out, as the effluvial byproduct of an altercation between the zeros and the ones? He didn't know, but there they were, stark, almost primordial in their simplicity. Nothing is not itself. Once again, the voice spoke as he read them, slowly and monotonously as before, but this time grinding them out as if for the hard of hearing. There was an air of menace about the enunciation, an air of fucking menace. He was not having this. He was not having this at all. First, the flat had spoken to him, random conjugations of terms, harmless linguistic paradiddles. But now his computer was attempting to insinuate double negatives into his consciousness. What was nothing if it was not itself? Or did it mean that everything actually was itself, i.e. self-identical? In which case, why state it in such a twisted and perverse fashion? He shuddered, shook his shoulders, and took a series of deep breaths to calm himself down. "I'm just filling the silence," he announced loudly, "making things up to occupy the void." The words trampled through the air like Wellington boots in mud, each one disgorging itself as it made way for the next. All of a sudden, the heavily curtained windows, the graffitied walls, and the littered floor seemed intensely but oppressive, and he knew that he only had seconds to get out, seconds before he had to re-engage with the world or disappear screaming somewhere inside himself. He grabbed his wallet from the table and dived for the door, crushing a thousand species of can and carton underfoot as he went. Wrenching his coat down from the peg in the hall, he ran for the front entrance, preparing himself as best he could for the trauma of his reinsertion into the social. But before he could even open the door, he stopped dead. For lying on the mat, there was a white envelope that he was sure had not been there before. He bent down and picked it up, noting the lack of inscription on the reverse as he did so. Slipping his finger inside the gap at the top, he ripped across and then shook out the contents onto the palm of his hand. It was a single sliver of paper, oblong, about 3 inches by 5, with what appeared to be a set of instructions written in minute script on one side. "Don't use superlatives. Avoid passives. No clichés. Watch howevers and buts." They were a formalized version of his own rather weakly applied commandments to himself, and what was worse, they were written in his own handwriting. Somehow, without knowing it, he had sent the message to himself. But if so, then surely that meant there must be two of him, one of which was conveying itself to the other beyond its ken, outside of its control. The left hand no longer knew what the right hand was doing. He was a split self. He stared down at his palms in horror, looking for any evidence, any sort of twitch or movement that would indicate autonomic functioning. In the hall mirror, he checked his disheveled image point by point, half expecting the reflection to lose faith, peel itself away, and walk off out of the frame. He was in trouble now. He realized that, much deeper trouble than he'd suspected. For if who he was and who he thought he was had parted company, and the one now found it necessary to communicate with the other by sending it disembodied messages, then there wasn't a he left in any simple sense, only something fractured and broken, something that perhaps opposed itself and would one day march off into a future of its own making. How far had he already gone down that road? What had he done? Where had he been? As he stumbled back into the living room, he heard the familiar clunk of the printer next to his computer as it sucked in a sheet of paper, and his heart sank. For God's sake, what was this? He hadn't set anything to print. Trampling through the garbage, he made his way across to it and waited nervously for the first sheet to begin to emerge. It was the beginning of a story. A story he had no memory of having written, something called Channel 3, and it was explicitly about himself. As the printer churned out the pages, he read, impossibly, the history of the last 20 minutes of his life, somehow already converted into text, right up to the moment where he had tried to get out of the front door. Then the narrative diverged, away from what had actually occurred, and followed its own course. There was no envelope, no set of instructions, no looking in the mirror. Instead, it reported a very different scenario, one that, as he read, Maiden, or the part of him that was left, couldn't help feeling with growing, nail-biting dread, might actually represent the truth and leave him no exit, no means of escape. All he was interested in was opening the door, getting out of the flat, being in the world once more. He had been blocked and lacking an outlet for too long, trapped in a body, effectively a carcass that no longer responded to his desires. The time had come for him to break free, to prise apart the ligaments and strike out on his own. He turned the key and pulled, was about to hurl himself into the corridor when a surge of instinctive adrenaline stopped him in his tracks, the same biochemical response that would have prevented him from throwing himself forward into a stream of traffic. For the truth was that the corridor, the stairwell, the neighbour's front door were not there. In their place was only light, a soft grey mantle like early morning mist that licked the edges of the doorframe and stole across the threshold. Maiden gazed into it, into its dawning heart, which seemed to offer at least some form of hope, and without a second thought for all that he was leaving behind, stepped out, became transparent, and then was gone. Thank you.